and cold today. High of only 16. Winds up to 35 miles per hour. Right now, sunny. Wind is from the west-northwest at 10. Temperature 3 above. Wind chill 12 below. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:10, Morning Show with Greg Berg next.
Support for the Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. It is a challenging environment for nonprofits. And of course, it is nonprofits who sometimes make the most significant difference in our world and in the lives, especially of those contending with various difficulties of one kind or another. And it's really important that nonprofits, especially those begun with the best of intentions and focusing on the most critical of issues, are created, founded with the most solid possible foundation. And one of the real keys to the success of a nonprofit can be in that phase of beginning. And a new book has just been published that explores some of the specific challenges that a nonprofit can face and explores some strategies in which some of those challenges can perhaps be best addressed. The book is titled Social Startup Success: How the Best Nonprofits Launch, Scale Up, and Make a Difference. The author, Kathleen Kelly Janis, has herself been a social entrepreneur and a lecturer at Stanford University and someone with wide-ranging experience in the whole realm of philanthropy, also an attorney, and co-founder of a nonprofit organization called Spark that we will talk about as well. She mentions this and many other nonprofits over the course of this very, very interesting book, and it just sort of excites one to think of all the good things that are going on in the world today. The book, again, is Social Startup Success: How the Best Nonprofits Launch, Scale Up, and Make a Difference, published by Dacapo Lifelong Books. Kathleen Kelly Janis, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thank you for having me, Greg.
And I really meant that last comment especially, that I am not starting a nonprofit. I have no plans to do so, but I thought your book was just so fascinating and exciting, even as someone not directly engaged. I mean, in other words, this book was not written for somebody like me. It's really, I think, at least primarily written for somebody who is about to start up a nonprofit and wants some ideas on how to do that most effectively. But even as a interested spectator from the sideline, I thought this was a really, really interesting book and full of inspiration just in kind of hearing about this wide array of nonprofits and the good work that they are doing. I wonder if the act of writing this book, the process of putting all this together, was maybe inspiring for you as well in a way that maybe you didn't fully anticipate.
Well, of course. I mean, as someone who writes about nonprofits, I have the benefit of getting to be inspired by these stories all the time. And certainly the interview process of going out around the country and interviewing 100 of the top performing social entrepreneurs in our country has been an amazing and inspiring process. And I think it really shows that it's not just those social entrepreneurs, though, who can make a difference. I mean, what was most inspiring to me about writing this book is that it's not just nonprofits that can make a difference nowadays, that we live in a society where really anybody can be a change maker, that anybody can get involved in social causes that they care about. It used to be just about writing a check and then being done with it. You know, they call it checkbook charity. And now donors these days want to be more involved. They want to volunteer. They want to roll their sleeves up. They want to use their skills to help nonprofits that are solving really hard social problems in our communities. And so my hope is that Social Startup Success will be a playbook for anybody who wants to make a difference.
I want to make sure I ask you about some terminology that you use. And I suspect that people who are involved in this kind of work are more acquainted with this terminology than I am, and you'll probably chuckle because I'm not going to be asking you about anything that's actually all that complicated, but nevertheless, I really don't fully understand the term scaling, or the phrase scaling an organization, but you say early in the book, the struggle to scale is the most pressing challenge for the social entrepreneurship community. I mean, after reading your book, I've sort of concocted an idea of what that means, but I think it would be helpful to our conversation if you really make that clear for all of us. What is involved in scaling an organization?
Well, if you think about impact as serving the community that you seek to help, let's say you're solving a problem of homelessness, what I saw is that the social entrepreneurs that I met who were working on these issues realized very quickly that they could do a very good job serving a handful of homeless people in San Francisco, for example, but that was really only going to make a dent in the problem, and that if you really want to make big change, you have to grow that impact beyond just a few homeless people in San Francisco, that you have to shift policy or you have to grow your organization to be able to serve more people. So scale can mean many different things depending on the context of the work. But in the book, what I really focus on is how can we help our organizations be more sustainable? How can we help them be stronger so that they're not constantly struggling to survive? What I've seen in my research is that nonprofits struggle. They're often solving some of the hardest problems that we have in our society, and yet they are working every single week to try and make payroll in their own organizations. And so I became really curious, well, how can we help organizations get to a point where they're not constantly living in this nonprofit starvation cycle,
right?
That where they're really thriving and able to focus on the problem solving as opposed to focus on just keeping themselves afloat.
Right. In other words, the main problem then can become that problem out there that they are wanting to address versus the problem that's sort of internal of how do we just keep ourselves going.
Absolutely.
Right. So
and it turns out that, the problem really, I think, is that 2/3 of nonprofits in the United States are $500,000 and below in revenue. Now, for many organizations, that's fine. There's a place for the small mom and pop nonprofit in every single community, and those organizations are doing important work. But for many organizations, it's not enough. That they need more resources in order to really tackle the problems that they're solving. And as a result, we have organizations that are ideas that are dying on the vine because they can't get the funding that they need. So I'm really excited about getting the tools in the hands of those nonprofits so that they can lay the foundation for success.
Right. So scaling then is not necessarily an organization expanding what they are doing. It is more a matter of expanding the stream of revenue that sustains them and might potentially allow them at some point to expand. But it's really about, in a sense, making sure that there is a healthy flow of revenue that makes it possible for them to do what it is they want to do.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. In the early days, it's actually much less about expanding and much more about focusing. Mm-hmm. In my research, I saw that the best social entrepreneurs implement a testing phase in the very beginning of their organizations to figure out which programs are working and really focus on those as opposed to expanding to try and solve all the problems at once.
Right. And I'm sure many people in this sector will appreciate the image of getting off the treadmill, that yes. If you have an organization that is working to the very edge financially, then day after day after day, life is a treadmill, and it just doesn't allow you to accomplish what needs to be accomplished.
Absolutely.
One of the things that is intriguing to me about the book is that you have talked to all kinds of people who have been engaged in starting nonprofits over quite an array of different sectors. And as I said in the introduction, that's one of the most interesting things about your book, beyond the sort of nuts and bolts advice that is here, is just it's also the story of many, many different nonprofits and why they have been created and in many cases the struggles that they had. And I am impressed that many of them are so honest and open with you.
Yes.
In terms of sharing the mistakes that they made in the startup phase. And, of course, without their honesty and openness, you wouldn't really have much of a book, would you?
No. I mean, let me tell you, it wasn't easy to find people to talk about failure. And, you know, that's a real problem with the sector in general, is that there isn't an incentive to talk about where you have failed when you know that you have to go out and raise capital next month from funders and donors who want to hear about your successes. And so getting people to talk about failure is generally very hard. Nobody wants to talk about where they have failed. But in the nonprofit sector in particular, it's really challenging. And even foundations themselves have to respond to their boards of directors or the families that they represent. And so even for foundations, it's hard to talk about failure. But I saw some great stories of people who are changing that, because ultimately we will not get better at what we're doing unless we are really examining what is working in nonprofit programs and also what is not working. And so, and I think this is a real trend. I think millennials have brought this trend, this idea of transparency, almost sometimes to the point of being cringeworthy. There's this really amazing website called GiveWell that talks about different charities that organizations should give to and has a whole analysis of different factors that make charities successful.
Right.
And then they actually have a tab on their website called Failures, where they talk about all of the different ways that they've failed. And, you know, you read some of it, and it's like way too much information for
right.
for some people. But on the other hand, when they approached Kari Tuna and Dustin Moskovitz, the co-founder of Facebook, to fund them, that was actually one of the reasons that they were funded, is because they were so honest about failure. Another funder that I interviewed, New Profit in Boston, talked about how one of the first questions that they ask nonprofits when they walk in the door is, where have you failed? And if they can't answer that question, then they're not being introspective enough about their work to get funded by that organization. So I do think that the sector is changing, and I ultimately think that it's for good.
I'm reminded of a line from the newest Star Wars movie spoken by Yoda, who says words to the effect that failure is the greatest teacher.
And, yes.
That's kind of what we're saying here.
That's the great Yoda.
Yes. By the way, I think it would make sense for us to just take a moment for you to talk about spark, what spark was and is, and the lessons that you learned as a co-founder of Spark back in 2004.
Well, Spark is an organization that I co-founded in San Francisco out of a need. I was a young lawyer at the time and looking for ways to get involved in the community here in San Francisco and wanted to roll my sleeves up and give my time and my money. And, you know, when I went to a bigger organization and pulled together as much money as I could and made a stretch gift of $250, which felt like so much money at the time, you know, they kind of patted me on the head and said, oh, that's cute. And, you know, of course, took my money, but then didn't really engage me beyond that. And what I realized in talking to my friends is that charity has changed. Charity used to be about writing a check and moving on. Now donors want to roll up their sleeves and get involved. And so we founded Spark as a way to get young people involved in philanthropy very early on to support gender equality issues and to help our peers realize in their 20s and 30s that you can give now and that you have resources at your fingertips to give and that it's not just about raising money when you're in your 60s and 70s and maybe lucky enough to have resources to give at that time. And so Spark has become, since that time in the last 15 years, the largest network of millennial donors in the world. We have 10,000 people in our network who are giving time and skills and money. These champions get together and collectively commit, for example, to raise $1,000 from their friends, which isn't a lot, but compared to the resources that nonprofits need to really run their organizations. But collectively, when you put all of these $1,000 checks together, it actually does make a big difference. And so it's showing young people how to give in meaningful ways so that they can be donors throughout their careers. To me, that's what's most exciting about the age that we're living in right now. When I talk with my Stanford students, I've seen a huge shift over the past 10 years since I started teaching at Stanford. It used to be about, am I going to go work at Goldman Sachs, or am I going to go and make money, or am I going to go work at a nonprofit and do good? People don't think like that anymore. These young people are thinking about, how can I both do well and do good in my work? How can I go get skills at Goldman Sachs, for example, or as a lawyer or as an accountant, and then transfer those skills as a board member of a nonprofit or as a donor and an actively engaged volunteer? So I think this really is an exciting trend, because the social problems that we are facing in the world today, whether it's climate change or increasing gap between the rich and the poor, the clock is ticking. We don't have time to wait, and we need all hands on deck to solve these problems. And the good thing is we have this army of social change makers who are ready and excited about tackling them.
I'm speaking with Kathleen Kelly-Janis about her book, Social Startup Success. Do you have a few more minutes for us to talk a little longer?
Absolutely.
Great. So you outline in your book five key strategies that are most important in terms of a nonprofit gaining this kind of financial viability that we're talking about, that in turn allows them to really accomplish what it is they have set out to do and to address the problems that are out there. As you are exploring the first of these, which is testing ideas, you point out something that you call a vexing catch-22 that faces nearly all social startups. Explain what that vexing catch-22 is.
Well, the challenge is that you need to have a good idea and you need to have results before you can make impact and get funded. But you can't get results until you have the funding to put into a program. And so this is a big challenge for early stage organizations. And one of the things that I hope to accomplish with this book is to show funders that there's a real gap in early stage funding, that organizations can't get off the ground if they can't get funded. And so what I've seen in my research is that what ends up happening is that the leaders that do get funded are organizations that tend to come out of Ivy League schools, or have access to their parents' basements to sleep in while they're starting their organizations, to be able to have some runway to do that testing without having to worry about getting a paycheck for, a several months or even years. So this is a real problem when we're talking about who is going to be best positioned to solve these problems, because oftentimes it's people who have lived experience, who live in communities, who don't have the luxury of sleeping in a basement for several months or foregoing a paycheck in order to start a nonprofit organization. So I think we really need to be thinking as a sector, just like we have angel funding for companies, how can we develop angel funding for people to launch their ideas? Because we have a lot of rich talent in communities that we should be developing if we want to really tackle social problems that we face today.
And you outline several different what you call core methods, which can be very, very helpful in tackling this, again, vexing catch-22, and I think you put that very, very well. As I was reading about this, this portion of the book, it was especially interesting to read about a term that we often use in another respect, and see it applied to this sector, and that term is proximity and gaining proximity. You quote a prominent civil rights activist by the name of Bryan Stevenson, who says that any nonprofit who wants to engage with a problem in its community really needs this proximity. He's saying we cannot make good decisions from a distance. If you are not proximate, you cannot change the world. So explain how proximity can make such a difference even at this early stage, in fact, especially in this early stage of a nonprofit startup.
Absolutely, especially in the early stages. Well, I think this gets back to the point I made about how so many of these ideas are coming out of Ivy League schools. And, you know, once you're in an Ivy League school, you have a distance from the community. And that's problematic in terms of really understanding the problem. My research showed that the best social entrepreneurs fall in love with the problem and not the solution. And the way that they did that was by really developing close connections to the communities that they served to try and create that feedback loop so that they were constantly improving on their product as they grew. So let me give you an example. Alejandro Gacartigas had this amazing story of parents who were in a drama troupe from Latin America, and so they were immigrants, and a really amazing family, very, very passionate about helping their kids get ahead in America, but didn't necessarily have the language skills or the know-how of how to navigate this new kind of school system. And so he grew up understanding that his parents, while passionate, didn't have the resources that they needed to fully support their children's education. So when he became a teacher, he saw this playing out with his own parents in his classes. And one of the issues that the school was trying to address was the summer slide, that kids weren't reading at home during the summer. And so these low-income kids were falling behind in their reading year after year after year. And so while the schools had thought about addressing it in certain ways. Because of his lived experience, because of his proximity to the communities that he was working with, because he was able to speak Spanish with the parents and understand what their needs were, he was able to understand that actually the problem is that the same problem that his parents had, that they didn't have the resources that they needed to support their children's summer reading. And so while the school was really focused on the students because they thought the problem was just that the students weren't reading enough, Alejandro had this really unique idea. Let's focus on the parents. Let's focus on giving them the tools and the strategies that they need to help support their kids. And his organization, Springboard Collective, has been an incredible success. They've seen increased literacy rates across the board in all of their programs. And it really goes back to this question of proximity. How do we create relationships with the communities that we're serving so that we can have a better understanding of the problem that we're trying to solve and to solve it in the most effective way possible? And I think this isn't just true for nonprofits. This is true for donors. We live in a society where it is very easy for us to sit happily in our bubble very comfortably without ever having to encounter people who are suffering, who don't have the privileges that so many of us are fortunate to have. And so I would love for us as a society to think more about how can we have better conversations so that we can understand each other's problems, so that we can have empathy for each other's problems, because ultimately that's how change is going to happen.
I appreciated, for instance, in this portion of the book, hearing from Rachel Armstrong, the founder of Farm Commons.
Yeah.
This is one of the first instances in the book where we really hear about, in a sense, a failure, or maybe a better way to put it is a mistake. I mean, a fairly serious mistake that was made right at the outset as this worthy sounding initiative was begun, and it turned out to be just slightly off target, and an important adjustment needed to be made before Farm Commons could go on to be something significant for Minnesota farmers. Can you just at least in brief tell the story of Farm Commons?
Well, Rachel is a fabulous example of someone who has proximity. She's from Minnesota. She works closely with farmers. She grew up in a farming family, and so she knows the problems that farmers face. But I think this is an example of even when you do have relationships with the communities that you're serving, sometimes they don't know what they need. Sometimes you have to test things out. Sometimes you have to figure out that maybe they say they want education about legal services, but what they actually want is they just want someone to solve their legal problems, and so really they need lawyers, which was what happened in the case of Farm Commons. And I think that this is a really great testament to the importance of social entrepreneurship, that social entrepreneurship is about fixing the underlying problems that cause homelessness or poverty or whatever the problem that we're trying to solve, as opposed to just putting Band-Aid solutions. And social entrepreneurs, because they're small and nimble, they have the ability to test these things. Nonprofits are the testing ground for government. Government would never be described as small and nimble, but nonprofits are, and that's a huge advantage when we're thinking about especially this testing phase and figuring out how can we come up with solutions that work and then leverage the government to bring them to scale.
Another nonprofit I would love to have you just talk about briefly, mentioned in this chapter, is a nonprofit called Donors Choose. Mm. And one of the things I love about this story is, although it is now, you tell us, a $100 million fully sustaining nonprofit with even celebrities on its board, it began in very, very humble fashion with a very, very simple idea. And yet, because they proceeded carefully and in logical fashion, it has grown to be something really powerful and important. Can you say a word about Donors Choose?
Yeah, Donors Choose is a wonderful story. It starts with Charles Best, who was a teacher in the Bronx and realized that his colleagues were spending their paychecks on school supplies for their kids. And already these teachers were getting paid so little, and yet they were being forced to use the very little extra income that they had on their students. And so he thought there had to be a better way, and he, at the time, saw technology coming into play as a possible option to leverage other donors to get people to fund projects that teachers might need funded. And so he started, as you said, with very humble roots. And this is a really important trait of social entrepreneurs, is that it's not about building a big platform and seeing whether it works. It's about doing small little tests, prototyping, and testing out ideas to see what sticks. And so in this case, he used $2,500 of his savings. He was living in his parents' home at the time, and so he was able to have a little bit of extra income from the rent savings to start a web platform. And he asked the teachers one day to come in and say, what are the projects that you would like funded for your class, whether it's a science experiment or a field trip or art supplies. And so all these teachers signed up, and they put their names down on the website. And he was so excited to get it off the ground, but no one was funding the projects. And so he ended up using the rest of his savings to secretly fund the projects. And the teachers were so elated that they got all of these projects funded that they ended up telling all of their teacher friends, and more importantly, all their parents and their friends and their family, about this new site where teachers can magically get their projects funded. And luckily, because Charles Best was out of savings at the time, and he was able to figure out how to get other donors on the website in order to fund their teachers' projects, and the nonprofit took off. And so I think this is a great example of how testing to figure out what works, being close enough to the problem and having that lived experience of having to spend your own money on school supplies, really made him an effective advocate for the cause, and ultimately his nonprofit a very successful endeavor.
I just love that story so much. You go on in exploring just this first of five key strategies to talk about how important it is to engage with all of the stakeholders, all who are impacted by the work that you do, in order to really make certain that you are doing what needs to be done, and doing it in a way that is effective and ultimately welcome. And in the third chapter, you actually return to something we've all already touched on, namely the fact that it is so important to make something good come out of the failures and missteps. The chapter is titled Reframing Failure as Learning. One of the things that I so appreciate here is that you talk here about honesty. You say one of the key reasons that so many social startups don't break out to achieve large-scale success is that their leaders are not willing to evaluate their programs with full honesty and to give up on ideas and approaches that aren't working. I happen to be a music professor in my other life, and those words remind me of what one hears from a composition teacher when you are sitting down to write a piece of music, and just because you came up with this sort of initial melody, a lot of young composers and some old composers for that matter, you know, just assume it must be wonderful, and yet if it doesn't yield fruit, if it isn't a fertile melody that really, from which all kinds of other wonderful music sort of organically grows, well, you need to crumple that up, throw it in the wastebasket, and start over. And a lot of young composers are just not honest enough with themselves, ruthlessly honest to know when that sometimes things need to be discarded, even if they sprang from your own imagination. That in and of itself does not make it a great idea or a fertile idea. And I think you're touching on something really important here in all kinds of different spheres.
Well, the challenge with music compositions is that ultimately the decision is in the hands of the listener, right? So whether or not, you know, someone actually likes a piece is a much more perhaps subjective question. In the nonprofit sector, we do have the benefit of metrics and of data to determine whether our programs are actually working or not. And I think the challenge in the nonprofit sector is that some leaders might not be honest with themselves because they maybe are too attached to their programs and don't want to really let them go. But in some cases, it's just that people are not really sure what to do with the data to try and analyze it so that they can be honest. So 75% of nonprofits say that they collect data about their work, but only 6% of them say that they feel like they are making good use of that data. And that's a real problem. And it's because we have this sector where people come from all sorts of eclectic backgrounds. They go into this work because they care about social problems. They're not going into this work because they're data scientists and they care about data. And so in Social Startup Success, I talk about some tools that folks can use to easily assess whether their programs are having an impact and focus on that data so that they can be honest about when they need to change programs or let them go or make them more effective.
Mm. I really appreciate in the chapter that talks about measuring impact that one of the things you caution nonprofits is to not fall into the trap of using the benchmarks of other kinds of measurement, especially the standard of return on investment, that is something that is more properly considered in other spheres, but not so much, at least in most of the nonprofit sphere. Is that fair to say, or am I overstating that?
Well, the problem with data is that it can be kind of seductive, I think, especially for a lot of donors in my region here in Silicon Valley. A lot of the donors are coming from the tech sector. And so these are people who have been successful in business and are really excited about the idea of applying business principles to the nonprofit sector. So thinking about things like return on investment as a way to translate what might be returns in the respect of a venture capital firm to philanthropy. And the reality is that, yes, data is critical to understanding whether your programs are having an impact. And if you don't care about data, then you don't care about impact. That's a reality. But we also have to be aware of the limitations of data and the limitations of trying to understand whether you're solving a social problem through data and whether that's actually an effective way to measure it. So an organization that I work with, Accountability Council, is trying to create better standards for international financial institutions like the World Bank for human rights and environmental abuses that might be associated with their projects.
Hmm.
So you can imagine this is a huge issue, and it's really a David and Goliath kind of situation. Accountability Council is a small $2 million organization based in San Francisco trying to hold hundreds of billions of dollars accountable in the world. And so their work, while extremely important, is not going to bear fruit for decades. I mean, the policy change that has to happen at the World Bank is not something that's going to happen overnight. And so if we're looking for data to try and show that they're on track to solving that problem, we're going to be in trouble. Now, does that mean that Accountability Council is off the hook from trying to measure their impact? No. But I think in certain situations, we have to adjust our standards for how we use data. Another example is this idea of looking at vanity metrics, which have been so prominent, I think, in the sector. Organizations love to talk about how many people they've served and how many people they've fed, or how many beds they've provided, how many jobs they've created. But the reality is that those metrics are meaningless without context, and we need to be honest about what those metrics mean. It's not just about whether you've given someone a job, but how are they working 5 years from now, or even 2 years from now? And so it's not just about using metrics to explain outputs, or how many people you're serving, but also outcomes. What are the long-term effects of your programs on someone's life?
We're speaking with Kathleen Kelly Janis about her book, Social Startup Success, How the Best Nonprofits Launch, Scale Up, and Make a Difference. There's much, much more in this chapter, but I want to make sure we touch on the other main points. The third of the five main points of your book is that it is important for nonprofit startups to do funding experimentation, that is exploring various means of funding. And I suppose that's one thing that a nonprofit might fail to do if people are operating simply from their own relatively limited experience in such matters, not realizing that there are a whole host of possibilities out there, and that they need to really explore them as extravagantly as possible. I mean, in terms of as wide an array of possibilities as they can.
Absolutely. I mean, we're living in this renaissance of philanthropy, that there is no longer one or two sources of funding for nonprofits, either individual donors or foundations or government, but there's all sorts of money available. And that is great and exciting, because it means that there are more sources of capital to fund the work. But it also puts the onus on the nonprofit to test different sources of revenue. There is no one-size-fits-all funding model for nonprofit organizations. It may be a combination of earned income and philanthropic capital, and lots of different sources. And what's important in the early stages is to test out these different sources to see what's going to be the best fit for your organization.
Right. You also offer some really interesting ideas in the fourth section on leading an organization and the importance of leading collaboratively. Among other points you make is that the media in many sort of high-level nonprofits like to focus on charismatic individuals who maybe it was their brainchild, or you know, maybe they're kind of the poster child for it, but that in a sense does not tell the story adequately about what it really takes for an organization, a nonprofit, to be fully sustainable. I want to ask you about something else later in the chapter, that is the notion of reversing the pyramid, which reverses a leadership framework that a lot of us have seen and might be pretty comfortable with. But you're suggesting that one of the options is to think about reversing that pyramid, inverting it on its head. What would that look like, and what would be the point of that?
Well, I think in our society, we love celebrities. We love talking about the celebrity leaders, and I think the nonprofit sector is no different. When we think about Wendy Kopp from Teach for America or Charles Best from Donors Choose, we like to kind of put these leaders on a pedestal and talk about their stories. But when you dive down into their organizations, it's a much more flat structure. But it's not to say that hierarchy doesn't exist and that there isn't a place for these leaders to go out and be the talking heads for their organizations to get funding and to get recognition and partnerships. But that millennials and young professionals these days want more ownership over their work, and ultimately, it's much more effective for organizations to give them ownership over that work so that they can have a much more distributed model and get more work done. So Kiva is a great example. This is an organization that has a crowdfunding platform to fund small businesses around the world. When Jessica Jackley and Matt Flannery started the organization back in 2004, they got lucky enough to get featured in Bill Clinton's Giving Book, and they were on the Oprah Show with Bill Clinton very early on after they started. And these two founders raised $11 million overnight. The Oprah effect is real. They crashed their servers and had an incredible success overnight and were able to get funding to projects all over the world and have become very successful in their work since. And so overnight, they had no choice but to switch to this kind of reverse pyramid model where they had hundreds of volunteers who were helping them screen their projects abroad. They were empowering their staff at every level to come up with their own metrics for success, to give each other horizontal reviews, not just vertical reviews. And this was a way to both practically solve the problem that they had to get a lot of work done very quickly and didn't have time for a hierarchical kind of structure that was going to bottleneck decisions getting made. But it also made their staff happier because their staff was able to take ownership over the problems that they were solving, to see the impact of their particular work on the broader mission of the organization. I mean, let's be honest, nonprofit professionals are not doing this work for the money. They're doing it because they care about having an impact. And so if you can empower your team with the defining of their own metrics for success, then that's going to give them instant gratification for why they're there.
Hmm. Finally, you advise nonprofits to be sure that they are telling compelling stories. Very specifically, creating a compelling narrative, which is a really, really nice way to put it. So in our closing minute or so, how does a nonprofit go about doing that so they aren't just sharing lovely anecdotes with the world, but doing something that will be even more important, meaningful, and persuasive?
Well, it's all about practice. I think we all have this tendency to hear a great TED Talk or political speech and think this person's a natural. But it turns out, as I went into my interviews, I learned that nonprofit professionals that are most successful really focus on the public speaking, and they really focus on telling their story and developing a compelling narrative. Because if they can't get people involved in their movement, then they're ultimately going to fail. And so prioritizing practice, not only at the leadership level, but at every single level of an organization, the staff, the board, the funders, the beneficiaries, is really the key to success.
Hmm. Well, there is much more to explore and learn in your really wonderful book, which again is titled Social Startup Success, How the Best Nonprofits Launch, Scale Up, and Make a Difference. And I want to say again that one of the most interesting things about the book is that we hear so many stories about so many nonprofits from all across the country, all across various sectors of our society, and hear stories about their successes, also about their mistakes, and about the good work that good people are doing across this nation. The book is published by Dacapo Lifelong Press, and the author, Kathleen Kelly Janis. Kathleen Kelly Janis, I really enjoyed your book and really enjoyed this conversation with you. Thank you for both.
Thanks, Greg.
Monday on the morning show, I'm going to be speaking with Patrick O'Donnell. He is a history professor who is one of the contributors to the next PBS American Experience documentary, which is called The Gilded Age. This refers to the late 19th century when the United States became a truly wealthy and significant economic power in the world. This is when people with the last name of Carnegie and Vanderbilt and Rockefeller came to prominence and really helped reshape our country and what life was like for Americans. But it was a complicated time in our period and a difficult period for some Americans.